Well, at first glance, when we look at this passage here, Rick read for us, it appears to be about washing our hands or sanitizing our hands. And you know, wherever you go in public today, you see these little hand sanitizers, and we might think that this is that's what it's all about. And this is just something about ceremonial washing. But there's a lot more going on here. And so as we look here, I want us to look at four different things here in this chapter, beginning with the opposition and accusation that is directed towards Jesus. Now, one of the things that the Jewish leaders were always getting at Jesus for was they were saying, show us a sign, show us a sign, show us a sign that you are indeed the Messiah. And when you think about what we just looked at, the feeding of the 5,000, I mean, what more of a sign could you ask for than the feeding of the 5,000? And so we would have thought that their desire for a sign would have been satisfied, and that now the leadership of the Jews would be like, oh, wow, this guy is definitely the Messiah. Let's follow him. But no. In chapter 7, verse 1, we are told that there's a group of Pharisees that have come to him from Jerusalem. Now, that doesn't mean that much to us in our modern day of hopping in our cars and just driving. But Jerusalem was possibly 80 to 90 miles to the south, depending upon what direction you went. So let me ask you a question. If you can walk 20 to 25 miles a day, how many of you, or let me ask this, how much opposition would you have towards somebody that you'd be willing to walk 3, possibly 4 days in one direction, knowing that you're going to have to turn around and walk those 3 or 4 days back in the other direction when you're finished? And I just say that because sometimes we might kind of think that, well, it's just a bit hard on the Jewish leaders. But the fact that these men were willing to walk, you know, a 3 to 4 day journey in one direction because of their opposition shows exactly what their heart was like. They were out to destroy Jesus because of their hard heart. And this time, the Jewish leaders, they thought for sure they had Jesus because they had caught some of his disciples. Why not all of his disciples, we don't know, but we know that his disciples were diverse. And so they had caught some of his disciples without having washed their hands before they eat. And although the accusation is against the disciples, it's directed at Jesus. And so they say, why do your disciples, Jesus, not walk according to the tradition of the elders, but they eat with defiled hands? Translation, other people's disciples, well, they eat according to the tradition of the elders. They don't eat with defiled hands, but your disciples do. That must mean that there's something wrong with your teaching. You're nothing more than a renegade rabbi, a menace to society. And so that's the behind this accusation. And Mark gives us a little bit of a background to what's going on here. And remember, Mark is writing to primarily a Gentile society. He's writing to the church, the believers in Rome. And so Mark gives us a little bit of background here in verses 3 and 4. where he says that the Pharisees and all the Jews do not eat unless they wash their hands properly, holding to the tradition of the elders. When they come from the marketplace, they do not eat unless they wash. And there are many other traditions that they observe, such as washing of cups and pots and copper vessels and even dining couches. And this word here that Mark gives us, the tradition of the elders, was a oral tradition that had been passed on. And what had happened was you had various rabbis who taught on the Old Testament law that Moses gave, and that was kind of collected together, put together, and that became the tradition of the elders. And that was elevated to be on par with the Old Testament scriptures, and even some Jewish rabbis elevated it even above. And so the fact that they're talking about this, and they're talking about their washing before eating, we might think that this is nothing about except about hygiene, except for the fact that Mark tells us that they wash after coming back from the marketplace. Well, why the marketplace? Why would they need to wash after coming back from the marketplace? Well, the answer is, at the marketplace, that's potentially could run into a Gentile, or they could touch something that a Gentile had touched. And so this would be like a white supremacist, should we say, feeling like he had to wash his hands after touching a black person. There was a desire to wash that came from an attitude of superiority. They were superior, these Jews and these Pharisees in particular. They saw that they were superior to these ungodly Gentiles. And so this washing in their eyes was nothing more than a way of justifying themselves in the eyes of God, and they were good as far as they saw, where the Gentiles, well, they were sinners. They were deserving of God's judgment. And it's the same kind of attitude that Jesus describes in Luke chapter 18 when he talks about two men going up to the temple to pray. One man, a religious man, goes up and he recognizes that he hasn't done any of these things. He is good. And the other man, a tax collector, and he recognizes that he is a sinner and deserves nothing, and pleads for righteousness. Well, we need to understand when it comes to this washing is we need to understand actually what did the Old Testament law prescribe? And the Old Testament law prescribed that for both the Jewish priests and the lay people, if I could use that term, that they were to wash anytime they touched bodily fluids or some kind of a dead animal or human being. If they came into contact, they were to wash. And apart from that specific regulation, particularly for non-priests, there was no requirement for them to wash. Now the priests, on the other hand, there was an additional requirement of some ceremonial washing, and that could be found in Exodus chapter 30, verses 17 to 21. And I'm not going to take the time to read there, but Moses had instructed the priests that before they came to offer sacrifices in the temple, that they were to wash. And there was a piece of furniture that was set up in the temple area. It was called the bronze laver. And this bronze laver was filled with water, and it was available only to the priests. And God instructed the priests to wash before they were to offer sacrifices to God. And the reason for it was to communicate to the priests, oh, I got sin in my heart. I need this sacrifice as much as Joe, I'm thinking of Joe Miller here. Joe Smith, who brought this lamb because he had sinned and laid his hands on it and we killed it, and now I'm bringing the sacrifice. Ah, I sin every day. I need this sacrifice also. And so the Old Testament law said that the priests were to wash daily lest they die. They were never to forget about the fact that they needed the sacrifice as much as the common people. And so in a sense, what these Pharisees recognize is like, oh wow, hey, this is a good commandment. You know what? We need to show God how zealous, how committed we are to His holiness and to pleasing Him. And so we're not just going to wash when it comes time for the, you know, offering sacrifices, or we come in contact with bodily foods. We're gonna wash all the time. See, God, see how good I am? Aren't you pleased? They missed the whole point. And the fact that they were encouraging the people to wash too. The fact that they were doing this, they missed the whole point. The point of washing wasn't just to get a little dirt off the outside. The point of washing was to remind them of the dirt inside. And the fact that they were encouraging the people to do this, they were preventing the people to see that the dirt. There might be some dirt on the outside, but the real dirt is on the inside. And so Jesus was opposed to the Pharisees, not just because of their mark of arrogance that they had, looking down at others, but because they missed the whole point of the purpose of the washing. And instead, they put in together the tradition of the elders. And the tradition of the elders was blinding people from the true holiness of God. And if you read Matthew's account, this really stands out how they had elevated their own words to replace God's word. Jesus defined holiness not just in mere washing. Jesus defined holiness in two great commandments. He summarized two great commandments: love God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your strength, and with all your mind, and love your neighbor as yourself. And when you recognize, oh man, how did I do on that this past week? I failed in both of those. God, I need mercy. Well, second, Jesus' condemnation. And he gives an example of this. As I mentioned, the Jewish leaders thought that they had Jesus, but Jesus turns their accusation around and shows their condemnation before a holy God. And he begins by quoting from the book of Isaiah. And this quote from Isaiah here in verse 6 and 7, "Well did Isaiah prophesy of you hypocrites, as it is written, 'This people honors me with their lips, but their heart is far from me. In vain do they worship me and teach as the doctrines and the commandments of men.'" The fact that Jesus is quoting from a prophet who himself was not welcomed by the religious leaders in his own day, that would not have gone unnoticed by the Pharisees. But Jesus, are you equating us with those religious leaders back in Isaiah's day who turned against you? Yeah. And the fact that Jesus says to these Pharisees, whose whole life was about being meticulous and being careful with absolutely everything that they do so that they can be holy in the sight of God. He says, all of that, if that's how you think you're going to please God and worship God that way, it is vain. It is completely vain. If you look at verse 7, the end of verse 7, we can kind of see their progression of how they got to where they were. Verse 7, the end of verse 7, Jesus says that they got there. They began by teaching their own commandments as if those commandments came straight from God. These are not my ideas. These are commands. These are things that you need to do. And they taught them as if they were on par with God's commands. Now, we can do the exact same thing when we take something that is gray in the Bible and we make it black. Now, some of us who are a bit older, we may have grown up, or our parents may have grown up in a home that said, well, you can't play with playing cards, or you can't go to dance. These are things that are gray, but we're going to make a law out of them. And the end result is we think that by doing them, we somehow have established a righteousness that is right in God's eyes. Or we could do the same thing today by if we begin to preach on how somebody has to school their kids, something that is not explicitly said in the Bible, or begin to say what kind of foods people use, or how you cook those foods. Again, those are gray areas. But Jesus said that they began their progression. And we'll see the end of their progression in verse 13. But they began their progression by taking their ideas. Maybe nothing wrong with the ideas, but they turned them into commands. And so the next step in their progression is in verse 8, where we see that Jesus says that you leave the commandments of God and hold to the tradition of men. They begin to neglect God's commands. And that's, we can understand that. If you are emphasizing your commands, then it's very easy to go down that path of neglecting God's commands. And then verse 9, we see the next progression. And he said to them, you have a fine way of rejecting the command of God in order to establish your tradition. So they went from great ideas. Those great ideas aren't just ideas. They're actually commands. And the focus on these commands made them neglect God's commands. And because they neglected God's commands, it was just natural for them to reject God's commands. And the final step is in their opposition and their outright opposition to the commands of God in verse 13. And they made God's commands void or meaningless. And Jesus gives a very simple illustration of how these Jewish leaders did that through the preventing of people obeying the fifth commandment through this giving of a gift, which they called Corban. Now, this Corban was just a Hebrew word that came from offering. And it was something similar to what we would do today with deferred giving. Deferred giving, you decide that upon my death, my money is going to go to X organization. But until I die, I remain in control of the money. And so we don't know what the motive for the person who set aside the money for the temple that Jesus is getting at here. It might have been done at a time out of genuine love for God, at a time when the parents of them were doing well. They were in a position financially they didn't need any help. And so it just seemed natural. They had no other places to give this money, so it just seemed natural for them to give the money to the temple. Then all of a sudden, some circumstances changed, illness of the parents or job loss or whatever, and all of a sudden now the parents needed help. And the priests, the Jewish leaders, had made it almost impossible for the people to take back their offering of and to give it to support their parents. Now, when you think about this, okay, we understand again why they would have set this up a little bit here. Okay, when it comes to, you know, today when it comes to setting up a deferred giving, we meet with somebody, they discuss it all out. Okay, is this something that you really want to do? Yeah, I think so. Well, why don't you take it home and think on it, and then come back, and if you have more questions, then we'll set it up. And so the same thing could have happened here. Okay, we don't want you just to do this frivolously. So if you do this, you need to recognize that you give, and there's no way of getting it back. And so that's exactly what had happened here. They were trying to make sure that people didn't make frivolous promises or things like that. But in their trying to make sure that the people didn't make frivolous promises, Jesus talked about the fact that when something came up, change of circumstances that was outside of their control, you actually prevent them from obeying the fifth commandment, which is to honor your parents. And the Apostle Paul tells us in 1 Timothy chapter 5, if anyone does not provide for his relatives, especially for the members of his own household, he's defiled the faith. He's worse than an unbeliever. Well, the reason why he's worse than an unbeliever is because part of the principle of honoring father and mother, taking care of your relatives, is, well, that's what God does for his children. God takes care of us, and so it's natural that we should take care of them. And the Jewish leaders, by setting up their traditions, was forcing people to deny their faith. And so, as it said, what started out in a good thing turned into a bad thing. And we see how they have replaced their words with their own, with God's words with their own. If you turn to Matthew chapter 15, where this passage is also in Matthew chapter 15, you'll see where Matthew really makes this, he says in Matthew 15 verse 4, he says, for God said, honor your father and mother, and he who speaks evil of father and mother is put to death. Verse 5, but you say, you see, there, great idea. You say, but God says. And so there is this replacement that is going on, and Matthew wants them to see that that they're setting up these traditions was causing the people to go against God. There's nothing wrong with tradition. That's not what this is against. But what Jesus is getting at here is they had replaced their tradition, small t, and made it a big T, and scripture, God's word, that had a big S, they replaced that and gave it a little S. And so because of that, they were under God's condemnation. Number three, deceitfulness with explanation. In verses 14 to 23, Jesus now goes back to deal with the problem that the Pharisees had with Jesus' disciples. They were concerned that the disciples were eating with defiled hands because they weren't doing the washing. And the Pharisees, Jesus is going to show, misunderstood what defilement was all about. Defilement was not about what was on the hands, the dirt that was on the hands, or the dirt that the hands might have picked up. Rather, the defilement and the darkness and the depravity was what was inside the human heart. And so Jesus gets right to the matter by showing the absolute folly of thinking that just because I eat something, that's somehow that's going to defile me. Now, it might make me sick, but it's certainly not going to defile me. And so we know that today, but we can make the exact same error that the Pharisees made back then when we begin to think, well, my problem that I have, well, it's because, well, I just didn't get the education that I needed, or my problem that I have is because, well, I grew up and, you know, my father was an abusive father, or my mother was abusive, or I grew up poor, or any one of these issues that we try to use excuses to avoid getting at the real issue. The real issue is my heart. I used to think I was a pretty patient person until my kids begin to show me my buttons. Now, they were always there, but I wasn't aware of them until my kids helped me to see them. And Jesus is saying, the problem with defilement is that the heart is deceitful. As Jeremiah said, it is deceitful above all things, and it is desperately sick. There's only one solution for the heart. The solution for the heart is what Jesus said to Nicodemus, be born again. It's what Ezekiel talked about in Ezekiel 36:5, when he said, your problem with your heart is you need a new heart. And that's only something that God can do. And so the Pharisees totally underestimated the wickedness in their own heart, and they thought, well, we can deal with this. I know. We'll just wash. We'll just wash and make sure that we shake all the water off, and it'll go away. The reason why Jesus didn't emphasize ceremonial washing with his disciples is because it doesn't work. Jesus knew that he would be laying down his heart. Jesus knew that the ceremonial washing that the Old Testament pointed to was pointing to an ultimate washing that God would do by giving them a new heart, that Jesus would accomplish for his disciples when he laid down his cross, or when he laid down his life on the cross. And so Jesus wants his disciples to recognize who's their greatest enemy. Their greatest enemy is not out there. Their greatest enemy is right here. Well, finally here, transformation of the unexpected here. Mark finishes this chapter with transformation of what two very unexpected people. This first one, this Syrophoenician mother, was a Gentile. And one of the difficulties of this passage is that as we read this passage, we think to ourselves, boy, Jesus is a bit harsh. I mean, I thought Jesus was compassionate. He's a bit downright rude, lacking compassion. And my answer to that, because that is the response of many people as they read a passage like this, my answer would be to that is, well, if this is the only passage that we have about Jesus that tells us how Jesus interacted with people, then it'd be safe to assume, wow, he must not be very compassionate. But this is not the only passage that we have. We have many passages that explain how Jesus was compassionate, and compassionate with females, compassionate with Gentiles. And so there's a number of them. And so when we come to this passage here where Jesus is visiting Tyre, and he comes to minister to this woman, one of the things that we need to remember as kind of background on this is that the Jews, your good Jews, should we say, especially your Jewish leaders, they had contempt for Gentiles, and they referred to them as dogs, and not the kind of dogs that we have that as pets, but the scavenger type dogs, the mangy dogs that you kind of want to stay away from. And if we combine this account with Matthew's account, we find that first of all, this woman comes to Jesus and she says to Jesus, "Have mercy on me, Lord, Son of David. My daughter is cruelly demon-possessed." Now, this woman calls Jesus, Son of David, Lord. When you go through the Gospels, you recognize that the only people that refer to Jesus this way are blind people or this woman. And so right away, that should clue us that there is something that is going on here above from what we would think, oh, Jesus is just being rude here. And so this fact that this woman sees Jesus as Lord, as Son of David, means that this Jesus recognizes, hey, this woman sees me as somebody totally different. This is a Canaanite woman. She comes from a religion that worships false gods. And then in verse 23 of Matthew, we find that again, Jesus didn't say a word to this woman's request. Although she came to Jesus and she said, "Jesus, Son of David, Lord, have mercy on me." Matthew tells us that Jesus is silent. And we don't know how long that silence lasts, probably not very long, because the disciples were irritated, and so the disciples said, "Send her away. She keeps shouting at us." And Jesus' reply to his disciples was that, okay, remember, and his reply to this woman also is that he came to minister to the last sheep of the house of Israel. But this woman was not going to allow that getting in the help of her, and she cries out, "Lord, help me." And it's at that point, according to Matthew and Mark, when we put them together, that verse 27 of chapter Mark comes in, where Jesus says his response to the woman that appears to be a kind of a heartless and cruel and insensitive comment in, "Let the children be fed first, for it is not right to take the children's bread and throw it to the dogs." Now, one of the things that we got to just remember is what just happened. Well, Jesus had offered himself. He had offered himself, bread of life, to the people of the Jewish nation, and they had said, "No thanks." And so this woman, who was desperate and needed help, and knew that the Canaanite gods couldn't do anything for her and her daughter, Jesus, in a sense, is saying, "You know what? The children have had all they've wanted. They don't want to have anything more, and this woman has. There's plenty to go around for this woman." Finally, the last one, the healing of the deaf man. It's only recorded here in Mark's Gospel. And I just want to make just a couple points that I think the reason why Mark put it here where he did. I think, first of all, is that notice that there's friends here that bring this man to Jesus. Friends, whether they heard about Jesus and they had personally been ministered to by Jesus, we don't know, or they just heard about Jesus and they, okay, our friend, he needs it. And we talk about, you know, friends don't let friends drive drunk. Friends, to be a good friend, we know that part of that is helping our friends to see Jesus. Philip did that. Andrew did that. And that's what we're called to do also. But I think the second thing here is one of the reasons why Mark put this right after the story of this Syrophoenician woman is that if there is any doubt whatsoever that Jesus is not a compassionate God, this just reconfirms, yes, Jesus is compassionate. Jesus seeks to heal this man who was a Gentile and who was deaf. And he reaches out to him and touches him. And so Mark sandwiches these stories together just to remind us that Jesus is indeed, he's a compassionate God. Jesus came to minister not just to the lost sheep of the house of Israel, but he came to minister to all. And the first thing Jesus does to his followers is he sends them to be his witnesses in those places. And this morning, as we celebrate the Lord's table, we're reminded that Jesus came to minister to us. Jesus, by his death on the cross, provided the only sacrifice that was sufficient so that we could stand holy and righteous in God's sight. Let's pray.